Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for coming this evening. We look forward to discussing the study that's been ongoing since 2010 on the New River, including the section above Plato Lake and all the way down to the West Virginia boundary. My name is Mark Richards. I'm from Department of Environmental Quality from the Richmond office. And I have served as the project lead for this specific study that we've done to hopefully hone in on some of the sources that are contributing to the fish contamination problem within the New River system. This is, we kicked off this actual study back in 2010, and for actual field investigative type work. And then officially we kicked this, our whole public participation process off about a year ago. I think it was, April of 2016, where we had our first public meeting. And we've also had a series of three technical advisory committee meetings, which is part of our public participation process, where we pull in stakeholders and kind of get into the weeds a little more on, you know, exactly what we're doing here and get some question and answer type sessions going on. The purpose of my presentation tonight is just to go through this on a more basic level. And if I would like to offer this right now, if folks have questions as I go through this, please just interrupt me and I'll respond to whatever thought you may have at that moment. Of course, you know, I'll also leave questions for the end, and then DEQ staff would be, if you have specific questions that I may not be able to answer, such as specific data, you know, like how contaminated are the fish, if you want to actually look at the numbers, then we can open up a laptop or some other means to show you afterwards and kind of get into that. So as I mentioned, our first public TMDL, and I'm going to kind of define that, what is a TMDL. We met back in April, and it was on the Radford University campus, and whether you attended that meeting or not, I don't know, but that was more of an open venue type situation where we manned all the posters and provided information as we went. But officially that was our first kickoff, and then tonight constitutes our second and final public meeting on this specific issue. So what I'm going to just kind of quickly go through tonight, give you a little background on PCB, what are PCBs, get into the problem identification, which is the fish tissue contamination. That's the purpose of this whole study. What is a TMDL, components, you know, some source investigation work that we've done, a little bit on computer modeling, you know, how we determine how PCBs are moving through the system, which is a very complex thing. And then how we, you know, where we find it's coming from and how we allocate it, meaning how we kind of parse it out amongst the different types of categories. And then what type of reductions we need to establish in order to ultimately reclaim the fish consumption use. In other words, the fish are fully safe to eat again. And then lastly, we'll talk a little bit about what comes next after this study, and that's the implementation of this project. And if you haven't seen, or if you're interested, if you go to the DEQ website, we actually have I can't give you the exact website location because nowadays they seem to be really long. But if you go through, you know, kind of work your way through the water issues and then TMDL and then PCB, you can find a whole lot of information on this New River project. Okay, just to give you a little background information on PCBs. These things have been around a long time. They were first originally manufactured in the 30s and 40s, well, all the way through the late 70s, when they were ultimately banned back in about 1977, 78. And because of that, they've been known as a legacy contaminant. However, they've kind of stuck with us all this time. They're so stable. They're heavily chlorinated. Chlorine's kind of a nasty compound. We all know we use it in bleach, kills everything. Well, because of that, it just makes them so stable that they just kind of hang around. And then you can see some of the common uses for PCB dielectric fluids, transformers, capacitors from the electrical industry was a huge piece of that. Hydraulic fluids used in machinery, and then some of these other, you know, PVC products. Carbonless copy paper was a significant source, and then even caulking. So we do find them in, you know, when buildings are destroyed, you know, like old buildings, you can actually find PCBs associated with that construction debris. PCBs are also in paints, and to this day, they used to be in paints at a lot higher level than they are now, but believe it or not, there's still a component that's in a yellow pigment. It's a certain yellow pigment, and then titanium dichloride, I think, or tetrachloride. It's a pigment for white. We find some signature associated with that. So that's kind of a current day thing, so not so legacy there. And then a little information, perhaps more than you're really interested in, but that's kind of what it looks like. There's 209 different possibilities for this contaminant. And again, it depends, you know, you get a chlorine attaches to each one of these things, and that's what kind of makes the differences between the PCB compounds. And Monsanto was the original developer of, or the manufacturer of PCBs, and they always referred to them as Aerochlors. Okay, so PCBs continue to be an issue, and why is that? We have collected some screening samples from like paper manufacturing, for instance, and we have pretty significant or elevated levels of PCBs coming from that type of point source. So it does kind of go along with that. So it's something that the pigment manufacturers are aware of this. EPA is aware of it. The problem is it's kind of the situation where if manufacturers of pigments in the States, you know, implement some, first of all, I don't think they have a magic bullet that allows them to produce those pigments without developing PCBs as a byproduct. But they've argued it puts them at a competitive disadvantage if they have to change their process. So that's, and also the levels that are produced today are nothing like back in the day. I mean, they're magnitudes lower. The problem is, as you'll see with some of our threshold values, we're dealing with really low levels that, you know, PCBs bioaccumulate and they biomagnify. It's part of this slide. Fish consumption is a significant exposure pathway, and this shows you, you know, EPA has suggested it to be a carcinogen. There's an international agency on research for cancer has actually upgraded it to a carcinogen. I guess that's over in the EU. And then these are some of the potential health effects associated with PCBs aside from being a carcinogen. And then this is the point I wanted to make. I've already mentioned they're persistent, but they bioaccumulate at very low concentrations. And that's why it kind of makes the inadvertent production of PCBs nowadays still an issue. It's still being manufactured and then released, you know, through these, you know, paper recycling or, you know, associated with their types of processes. And the other thing about PCB, not only do they bioaccumulate, which means they get into the fatty tissue of fish, but, you know, every step of the way, they're in the water column at a very low concentration. Then all the little plankton and algae and zooplankton kind of gets in them, and then the little fish eat that. And so as you go up each level to the fish, you know, the top predators or the fish that we like to target, you know, it magnifies to a level that is certainly of concern for us. And then, as I've already mentioned, and I've kind of talked about confirmed ongoing releases, we use methods nowadays that allow us to actually detect it being released from different sources. So DEQ goes around the state on a 3 or 5 year basis, depending on available funds. And we hit different river basins, and we, you know, through our DEQ fish tissue monitoring program. And what we're doing is essentially monitoring to determine whether or not we're meeting the fishable goal. In other words, are fish safe to be consumed by humans? And the, you know, Clean Water Act requires us to do that, which is a great thing. And then the PCBs kind of get into the fatty tissues of the fish. They tend to favor that. You know, PCBs, pesticides, that's why a lot of like chlordane and DDT and some of those pesticides have been banned as well, because they're having chlorine and they end up in the fish. And pesticides have of course affected birds in the past. And then when we collect our fish, we get it analyzed and we compare it to trigger values, fish threshold or tissue thresholds, which I'll cover in a minute. And those are really set to protect human health. And then if those thresholds are exceeded, it gets listed on the dirty or the 303D report, otherwise known as the Dirty Waters report. And I hope you can see this, but this is the fish tissue. Each point there represents a different type of fish. And this is also in our report, and it's, which is online, so you can get a better look at it. These reflect tissue that were collected from 2004 through 2014. And we have two different thresholds here, which I'll describe in a little more detail. The health department is this red line right here. And the DEQ has a screening threshold that set at about 20. And I guess the units, I really won't get into that, but it's 20 is the DEQ, and the 100 is the health department. And the other point I want to make is, as you move from the upper section of the river is up here, so this is Reed Creek, and this is what we're calling the Upper New River, which goes up to the 77 Bridge. We're going down river from there. Peak Creek is right here. Walker, well, these are some tributaries that are have a problem. And then the Lower New River from Clater Lake Bridge all the way down to the boundary. So the point is, as we go down river, the fish go higher in contamination. I think that's been listed for water. Has Walker Creek been, is it listed for water exceedances? We know there's a source up in Walker Creek. It's the old Bain School. That's what we refer to it as. Here's the actual consumption advisory. So we may have listed that because of our past work, our source investigative work, where we found a source up in Sugar Run, as Mary just alluded to. And I know we've, I know we've collected some water data in these tributaries, and water exceeded our threshold. So I don't remember the fish values. Okay. The fish tissue did not exceed in Walker. It was the water values that did. So I'll show you here in a second. I don't want to get too far. I'll show you a threshold for water that we use. Again, one of the major points here is upriver, the contamination is less. And once you get to the Clater Lake Dam moving downriver, the contamination goes up. So this is the actual VDH consumption advisory. And I've been referring to Lower New River and Upper New River. So just to give you some perspective, the Upper New River is the section up here that flows into the headwaters of Clater Lake, and it kind of includes Reed Creek. And then the Lower New River is at the dam all the way down to the boundary. So just to kind of give you that perspective, the lower section is about 68 mile impairment. And of course, Clater Lake is listed in this impairment as well. Again, the heavier contamination downriver is reflected by the do not eat carp. And then the the lesser contamination is reflected by at least the recommendation for no more than 2 meals per month in the upper section. And carp are by far the worst, or one of the more significant accumulators of this PCB material. The health department initially listed in 2001, and again, that was based on the DEQ fish monitoring. The health department establishes the health guidelines for consumption of certain fish species. They recommend a number of fish per month, as I just mentioned. Then they also provide suggestions on cooking and preparing the tissue. And I know this was a question asked earlier. This contamination in the river does not affect recreational use, boating, swimming, and you know, other water activities. This contaminant tends to attach to sediment. You know, when the water's muddy, you know, you get all that mud in the, suspended in the water column. When that stuff settles, that's what the PCBs are primarily attached to. And you probably get a lot of settling above the dam. Well, there's a lot of prospective sources downriver that we,
below,
I mean,
the,
right.
Sure, you
right.
used to have.
So, so there is probably a component coming from the lake itself, but it's not as significant as what's being introduced below the dam. So typically, you know, just a broad statement is when we do fish tissue analysis around the state, you look at carp, you look at catfish, they tend to be higher. And I mean, you'll see it in some, you know, upper, you know, like big bass and things like that. The higher, you know, they eat everything and they kind of accumulate everything as they eat it. So that's again why it's recommended you eat smaller fish.
Yeah,
just from those mining operations, they use a lot of electrical equipment, a lot of hydraulic fluids in the big machinery. So those are always prospective sources as well. PCBs are a man-made substance. They don't come naturally from, and when I say pigments, you know, it's primarily from the manufacturing process is where it's generated. It's not, you know, they use heat, they use, you know, like carbon material and they mix a little chlorine with that and it just kind of ripe for kind of accidentally producing these things. Okay, and then this is just kind of explains the impairment a little bit. You know, like I mentioned, we have to list it on our dirty water report. And that was first done in 2002. It was extended in 2006. And then we initiated this study in 2010. And we actually had some exceedances. And I'll describe that in the water column. Okay, and then to get into what is the total maximum daily load? Virginia and other states around the nation are required to perform these studies and develop a total maximum daily load for those waters that are considered impaired, don't meet our designated uses. And again, the Clean Water Act Section 303D requires that, and ultimately it yields a pollution budget. We address different pollution categories, and you know, to deal with this particular contaminant, it's a multimedia approach. What I mean by that, a multimedia approach to address and then solve. So we look at different types of sources, and they can be land-based, and we also do a lot of work in the water. And believe it or not, PCBs, and as the gentleman suggested, they burn this material that might be contaminated, it may be dispersed that way. It can be an air problem, but that's an area that we don't quite know much about other than what other people have studied. And then ultimately, this is what we want to do. We want to achieve this, like a certain amount that's considered to be safe for the fish and then for us to consume those fish. So we have a current or existing condition. You can see it's way above that red line. And then the goal is ultimately to reduce the existing PCBs to restore the use. So that's kind of what our target is here. And because PCBs are so persistent, they've been around forever, this isn't something that's going to happen overnight. It's going to take a while. What we hope to do through studies like this is find sources and cut them off or reduce them, so eventually the system comes back. These are the different thresholds I've been alluding to. The health department, again, they have a what they'll list a consumption advisory at 100. DEQ has a value of 20. And then we actually have a water value, and that's what this is right here, set at 640. And for this specific study, we used available fish tissue and water data to develop some special numbers that we employed within this study. Lastly, and this pertains specifically to the lower section of the New River below the dam, we have to meet the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection number at the state boundary. So what that does, and that's a requirement by federal law. So that even requires us to make greater reductions below the Clater Lake Dam. Yeah, it's a number they developed back in, I think, 1999, 2000 timeframe. And what they've done is it's all couched in, or they do a risk assessment, and it's like how many cancers are, you know, they willing to allow. So they've gone with the most stringent. They're willing to allow one cancer out of a million people. So that's extreme, real stringent. Virginia is more in the, will allow one cancer in 100,000 people. So that's like a policy type decision that people make when they develop those numbers. And these numbers are developed using EPA guidelines. EPA has to kind of sign off on these. So what we did here, I mentioned that we came up with lower values for this study, and why we did that is because that number, that 640, assumes fish are only get PCBs from swimming around in the water. It discounts what they eat. It discounts like carp rummaging through the sludge and sediment and on the bottom of the lakes. So we feel that if we use site-specific information, information from each segment of water, then that's more relevant than using a method or a value that was set to protect. It was more of a statewide value. And just to give this a little perspective, and this is what I talked about earlier, we're talking very small concentration here. To meet our state water quality criterion, one drop of contaminated water within all these Olympic-sized pools would meet that value. So we're talking incredibly low level. But again, it's important because of the bioaccumulation, biomagnification aspects of this nasty contaminant. All right, get into the components of a TMDL study. I've already kind of talked about the problem that we're confronted with, and I'll get into a little bit of a source assessment. And then once we find the contamination, we need to link it to the targets, and what that means is plug it into a computer model, and it does some of its magic, and it kind of measures the fate and transport of this contaminant within this really complex system. And then we kind of divvy up the amounts of PCBs to the different categories, and we set those at necessary amounts to meet that red line that I showed you on that graph. So we need to cut back on all the different sources. And then this is ultimately what we come up with, and that's what's in our report. TMDL is just the sum of the WLA as a waste load allocation that's associated with regulated point sources. And then this piece right here is associated with non-point sources. They don't come out of a pipe. And then the last thing is just kind of additional conservative inclusion within that equation. Okay, so back in 2004, DEQ performed, you know, The initial consumption advisory came out in 2001. DEQ listed it in 2002. DEQ responded to that by designing and developing a study, and the goal was to identify, obviously, to identify PCB sources. DEQ put together a source committee, or a source, a citizens group to help kind of hone in on these prospective sources. And it was really kind of getting at information like what you have, you know, prospective mining, operate, you know, just different ideas that people had. Again, it provided that local perspective. DEQ would design and a plan to implement, and then that would be reviewed by that committee. So I guess there were a total of six meetings. It's not something I was part of. It was more of a regional effort. But that took place between 2002 and 2004. And originally, they had over 1,300 types of facilities they were looking at. They developed a screening criteria, you know, kind of whittled it down to 335, you know, following these different types of criteria, and then whittled it down even more until ultimately they surveyed 80 facilities, did some phone interviewing, and then they did actual inspections at 48 facilities. And trying to use limited resources was the intent of this kind of whittling down the whole effort. And what they did at that point in time is targeted 18 facilities and two streams for a total of 47 samples. Now, back at that point in time, we primarily targeted either soil or river mud, or sediment. It's referred to as sediment. And that's where, again, like I described, PCBs tend to, you know, attach to those sediment particles, and they kind of drop out of solution. So that's kind of why we did that. And our analytical methods weren't very good at that point in time. So you look at it where it's collected and concentrated. This full report is on the DEQ PCB website, as I mentioned, or as I alluded to earlier. So that was a big effort back then. And then we had a little bit of lull until we initiated this. We knew a TMDL study was going to have to be done, and we initiated this, designed it, initiated it in 2010, and collected samples through 2015. So we took that earlier source investigation or identification project, we kind of used that as a basis to hone in on this study. So this study was part of source identification, but also to help us develop the fate and transport of PCBs in the system. Let's see, so 2010 through 2015, we collected fish tissue, water column samples, and that's what he's collecting right there, an actual water sample, sediment, or, you know, like river mud. We collected a total of 131 water samples, and that may or may probably doesn't sound like a lot, but these things cost $600-$700 a piece, so with limited budgets, we try and do what we can and put these where we can. But with that information, the newer method allows us to get to really low levels. So the example here is the method that was used back in 2004 could look at PCBs. You know, you're out in space, you look at Earth, and you can see the United States from that picture that's on the left side. So, you know, maybe you can see Richmond, maybe not. The method we're using now allows us to go from there all the way down to the DEQ building is right here. So that's our capability now. So we're able to see these contaminants that in the water column. We can just go collect a 2-liter sample and boom, we get a result. And it's a very good result that targets the full 209 compounds. The PCBs tend to weather when they're in the environment, and that other method doesn't allow you to see the weathered compounds. That's something we pick up here. And what I mean by weathered is they might change from one to something else, and the other method isn't set up to determine that. And this kind of allows us to what we call source fingerprinting, and I'll talk about that at the very end. And then we've been using this method for a little while, and it's really helped us immensely, but it is expensive. And these are the results. Again, starting on the way left side from Reed Creek, moving downriver to the right. As I mentioned earlier, we use different values for different segments based on site information, you know, river, or, you know, like Reed Creek information, Upper New River information. And those values are shown by each of these dashed lines for that particular segment. Essentially, when we develop our fate and transport model, this is the target that we're looking for to achieve in the stream in order to, you know, get this stuff out. And that's our ultimate objective. So you can see the values are definitely elevated. Okay, so what we conclude from this effort, you know, we identified some hotter areas, the elevated numbers that showed up. This kind of gets to your question about, you know, replicating a result. It's hard to, you know, capturing these high flow events it's a challenge. A lot of times they happen at night, or, you know, it's just not opportune times when you can deploy a team out there to collect these samples. We use these data for the development of this project, and then we also had some regulated point sources collect information concurrent with this study. We collect low flow and high flow samples, as we talked about. The low flow samples, you know, the river's really low and clear, and we call that base flow. Those values tended to be really low in the water column, and that reflects what might be coming from the air. And what we learned from that is, you know, we haven't done specific air studies. We know it's a data gap, but it's just not something we've been able to do. But there was a study done on the Chesapeake Bay back in the late 90s, and we've kind of used those as default literature values that we plug into these. We learned quickly that if those numbers, deposition numbers, were plugged into the model, that it was grossly exceeding these base flow conditions. So what that tells us is that the air depth is not as significant in the watershed as at least those values tell us. So air can definitely be a problem. Like, let's say you have contaminated sites in Pulaski. You get some off-gassing, you know, these things will kind of go in the air and then they'll deposit in a local fashion. So it's certainly plausible to have gradients of PCBs based on air depth, air deposition. But I think one of our conclusions from the broader study is that air is not contributing as much as we thought. But that would be really something nice to, you know, it's something we recognize that needs to be done. It's just a matter of getting funding to do an actual air study. And that's a really interesting point. And that, I'm going to get into some of that on our implementation, you know, the few slides I have. It's an area, I used the word fingerprinting earlier, but that's the area where we're going. We've just started developing a process to do that. Okay, so I'm just going to quickly go through the bigger picture of how PCBs move through the system. Again, you might have the contaminant within the water column. It's kind of in a dissolved phase when it's in the actual water, and then it really likes to attach to sediment, the little particles. They drop out, they kind of get into the bottom. They settle, and then they might resuspend, so they kind of go back and forth, you know, depending on what's going on with storm events. So then we have these inputs. It might be industrial effluent. Combined sewer overflows is not an issue in the New River, but that's a source category we have for this study. You might have contaminated sites, you know, spill sites that have not been properly cleaned up or perhaps never cleaned up. You get the flow into the river during the storm events. And then I mentioned the off-gassing. You get stormwater runoff, and that includes non-regulated stormwater as well as regulated stormwater. And then we have wet and dry deposition, so it's an air component. And then you have a possible contaminated sediment. So these are the different categories that we've looked at and considered within this study. And then the computer model kind of simulates all these different things going on. So it's, like I said, it's a very complex thing. So TMDL source category, again, is point sources. These are regulated permit facilities that have permits. And we've asked a certain number to screen for this contaminant. So there was a total of, in this particular study, there's a total of 10 wastewater treatment plants. We have five, the really large industrial facilities. And then the third category are the industrial stormwater from what we call a general permit. These are the smaller facilities. Might be like a metal recycling operation, something like that. It could be like 20, 30 acres, and you know, it's just a different category of a facility. And then we assign, each of them are assigned a certain amount that they're allowed to release. And within the watershed, this is the location of all these outfalls or facilities. The other component of the point sources is the municipal regulated or separate storm sewer system, what are referred to as MS4s. These are like Virginia Tech, Montgomery County, Town of Blacksburg, and so forth, Radford University, and even VDOT roads that are within certain areas of that receive a permit. So these areas, you know, they might have contaminated sites within their jurisdiction that they may not know about. So we try and we're trying to account for that. So these permits are assigned a waste load allocation as well. Another source category, the contaminated sites. In fact, this is the Magnox Pulaski site right here. We look at facilities that are undergoing a corrective action process. It's an EPA-led program that DEQ Land Division participates in. We have former manufacturing facilities, again, the Magnox Pulaski site. We have sites that don't really fall under the premise of a permit, so the owner might know there's contamination, and they work on an agreement with DEQ, and it goes in as volunteer remediation. And then there's landfills and rail yards and spurs, and then miscellaneous sites. And then we have a uncharacterized component. And again, this is kind of a mixture of all of the types of sources that we don't know about at this point in time. We haven't actually been able to identify their location. We know there's a component of this contributing to the problem. It's my thought that, you know, even though we've screened some of these point sources, they are more than likely contributing more than we know. And to account for that, a large site has been assigned a certain load, an amount that they can contribute, and that it's going to be up to the facility to figure out where it's coming from. So they're definitely going to have to do additional work to get those reductions. And then we know that contaminated sites may not be remediated properly or adequately. And then, of course, there's unknown sites. We just can't account for everything that's out there. And then the localized atmospheric deposition. So we've created a specific equation or pollution budget for each of these, Reed Creek, Upper New, and then and so forth, for each of these systems. So now I'll just quickly go through, you know, how this is kind of simulated with in the computer model. Again, they take the whole area, the drainage area that feeds into the New River watershed, and they more or less run three different models. One that looks at the flow, and then once they have that figured out, they look at the sediment that moves through the system, the stuff that resuspends, the stuff that comes off the watershed or the land, and it's just kind of a simulation of how that moves through. And then finally, they take the PCB data that we have and determine how that moves through the system. Again, it's very complex. So this is the type of information that feeds into this computer model. You have, you know, weather, meteorological data. You look at the topography of the area, the different streams that feed into it, the different land use in the area. And then we use the observed data that we showed before, and the flow from the different sources and sediment load and the PCB load. So that all kind of goes into the computer model, and then the model has information that comes out, which simulates the flow, simulates the sediment concentration, and then ultimately the PCB. Yeah, they go through a calibration process, which can be quite complex. And then ultimately, what the objective of this model is to get to that, you know, if you look at, think about the original model I showed you, meeting that red line. That's what we're trying to do here. And then once they get to that point, the TMDL is complete. So that's it's an extreme oversimplification of this process. And our Virginia Tech contractors are here to explain further if anybody has specific questions. Okay. For purposes of this study, we did not actually develop that TMDL equation for Claytor Lake. And the reason being is we feel, based on our land use investigation, that the input is coming in from this section of the river and Peak Creek. That's where you're getting the significant inputs. So we feel that if those are reduced, then that will help the lake. Of course, there's contaminated sediment within the lake, and until that eventually becomes buried or is removed via dredging, if that happens, that's really the only way to address that. So it didn't really serve the purpose of this particular study to develop an equation for Claytor Lake. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Again, we feel that getting reductions in the upper section as well as Reed Creek and Peak Creek will make a significant impact. And then this is the relative contribution from the different systems. Reed Creek is that's on the far left. That's a system that we haven't looked at as significant or as much as we've looked at the lower river section. And the permitted facilities that are up in Reed Creek, actually Withville area, have not been screened to this point. However, we were able to just take data that we have from a statewide database from these types of facilities. We assign them a load, and the first thing they're going to have to do when this TMDL is completed will be to screen their effluents. So it's certainly possible that they're contributing more than an estimated 4% to the system. Peak Creek, even though we've investigated it to a greater extent, there's still what we consider to be an unknown or uncharacterized component at about 46%. The town of Pulaski, I mean, there's definitely a lot of old industry there. I mean, it's definitely coming in from that system. So this just gives a different look at the lower New River. And again, this is by far the most contaminated. And the most investigative work has been done in this area. Even with that said, there's still a decent unknown component. But I'll get into the implementation side of it, like what we're going to do about this. There are definitely some facilities that need to be looked at, no doubt. But it's not the whole, I mean, it's not the entire picture. You know, like in Peak Creek, for instance, there's a metal recycling operation that was run there that they kind of went out of business, and we know that's a contributing source. It was Pulaski Cycle Systems or something like that. It shut down. I'm just wondering to what extent it's been cleaned up. Okay, so this is the, you know, kind of like the bottom line conclusion. The blue line represents what we feel is going into the system, and this is from all sources. And the red represents what we need to get to kind of bring it back so we can safely eat the fish. So it's significant. I know we got some pretty high water values in Walker Creek. Maybe we should, you know, after the meeting, just look specifically at those data sets now, maybe help just answer your question. Yeah, this might not necessarily be reflected in the fish, but again, a lot of it's probably scoured out of that system. So the last piece of this is kind of getting into what we're going to do about it, kind of talk about the implementation side. What we'd really like to do with this particular project is TMDLs, by regulation, we're required to develop an implementation plan. I'll kind of describe that a little more. One of the first things that's done, you know, we work with the point sources through our permitting program. So we put them into what we, if they exceed the allocation they're given, we put it into what we call a pollutant minimization plan. And that's kind of a iterative, you know, we work with them, they try and find the hot spots and get it reduced and test their effluent and see if they've made a difference. And if they didn't, then they have to go back and look further and test again and so forth. So that's kind of a permitting methodology or approach to address this. And again, we can do it through our regulation program. And then there's the non-point source, the contaminated sites, the unknown sources, things like that. And this is what I was going to talk about, the fingerprinting. We're going to start looking at these big data sets. You know, each sample, you know, when you look at that chart, it's one sample or one dot represents one sample, but you'd be amazed at how much information is in that one dot. And that allows us to do what we call fingerprinting and kind of look at some of the PC, you know, numbers 205 or 6 and 9 come from the paints, titanium dioxide, that's the pigment. And then, so we'll do some source fingerprinting. We can do that, that's tabletop type work we can do. And we look, hopefully it'll help us hone in on some uncharacterized sources, investigate hotspots, and then, you know, we can do some deliberate monitoring based on that information. And then ultimately, you know, once we develop an implementation plan, then we can look for different sources of funding to work on some of this. So again, this is kind of an overview of the pollutant minimization plan. We work with our regulated point sources. The facility submits and DEQ approves a plan. It could include backtracking up their system to look to see where it might be. Do they have a manufacturing process that might contribute? Whatever the situation is, they identify the source, and then they do some work to remove it, and then they reevaluate to determine whether or not the problem still exists. So it's kind of a, you know, all to kind of hopefully get down to that level where it, you know, they're no longer contributing to unsafe levels.